This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, J. Craig Venter, is a pioneer in the mapping of the human genome. This year, his team was the first to publish the full genome of a single individual. The full genome means it includes the chromosomes inherited from both the mother and the father. The person whose genome Venter's team mapped was Venter himself. A few years ago, Venter's privately funded team raced with a consortium led by the National Institute of Health to publish a first draft of the human genome. At a press conference led by President Clinton in 2000, they announced a tie. Now Venter claims to be close to creating artificial life in the form of a bacterium that he thinks can be used in the creation of biofuels. Earlier in his career, Venter was the first scientist to sequence the genome of a bacterium. Venter is the founder and president of the J. Craig Venter Institute. He's written a new book called A Life Decoded, My Genome, My Life. Craig Venter, welcome to Fresh Air. Since we're going to be talking about your work, sequencing the human genome, we should explain exactly what that means, sequencing the human genome.
Well, it's actually a good question. So, because people use mapping, sequencing, all kinds of different terms interchangeably. First of all, the human genome is our complete collection of genes, all our DNA information on our chromosomes that we inherit one set of from each of our parents. So we actually have pairs of chromosomes. We have 22 pairs of, they're called autosomes, and then we have the sex chromosomes. Women have two X chromosomes. Men have an X and a Y. So the process of actually sequencing the genome is determining the exact order of the four different letters, the A, C's, G's, and T's that comprise, that are used to dictate the, indicate the chemical letters of the genome. We have 6 billion of those in each of our cells, of those letters, and determine the price order on the orientation of those down our chromosomes. Actually reading the genetic code is what we do with sequencing the human genome.
And what does that tell us about who we are?
Well, it in fact shows us everything about our evolution as a species. When we sequence the human genome, the anticipation was by many is that our genetic code would be totally unique and not resemble any other species. Those that wanted humans to be separate from all other life, I guess, were hoping for that. Some people were hoping for 300,000 genes, and a couple of biotech companies claimed they had patented 300,000 genes. It turns out our genetic code has around 23,000 genes, not all that different from any other mammal. And more importantly, while we differ from each other in the 1% to 2% range, we differ from our closest relatives, the apes, the chimpanzees, by maybe 5 or 6%. And when we look at gene sequences, the portions that actually code for proteins, we're only on the order of perhaps 1% different from chimpanzees and less than 10% different from all other mammals at that level. So it gives us hints about our evolution. We can look at what's different in our genome versus the chimp genome to maybe see how we developed a larger brains, the ability to speak as examples. But it also tells us the basis of our biology. Each one of us has a totally unique genetic code, with the exception of identical twins. But they have other unique manifestations in terms of no two people have the same fingerprints, even identical twins, because of random changes as we go from one cell to 100 trillion cells.
What kind of genetic database would you eventually like to have, and how would you like to use it?
Well, our goal is over this next decade to see if we can get as many as 10,000 human genomes. And just having the genetic information on its own is not very useful. What we need along with it is all the phenotypic information, health outcomes, psychology tests, et cetera, so that we can begin to solve what this data allows us to solve, that is, what's truly nature, what's truly nurture, and the wide variety of traits and diseases, I think we can answer some of those questions in a pretty definitive fashion. But the interesting things is it may be slightly different and will be slightly different for all of us, depending on which genes changes and gene sets we have. But I think we have a chance in the near future to answer most of these questions that are pretty commonly asked throughout humanity.
We mentioned the question of nature or nurture. What are some of the other questions that you feel like you could ask with this genetic database?
Well, it's very key as we go forward with the constant double-digit inflation in healthcare costs in this country to see if we can go much more into a preventative medicine paradigm. If we know which diseases we're at risk for, we can, in most cases, start to do something about them, either in terms of early diagnosis, actually changing lifestyle, as I discussed for heart disease, and early treatment. Most cancers are not directly genetic. Only a tiny fraction are caused by changes that we inherit from our parents in the genetic code. Most of them are from changes we collect in our bodies over our lifetimes from X-rays, from environmental toxins, etc. But if you know that you have an increased risk genetically for, say, colon cancer, the statistics are pretty overwhelming in terms of if you can detect that cancer before symptoms appear. Colon cancer detected early is very treatable. It's not very expensive to treat with surgery. And the longevity outcomes are quite encouraging. Over 90% live longer than 10 years after a diagnosis. So I view genomic information as providing power and control to individuals over our own lives versus just waiting for happenstance and symptoms to appear.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Craig Venter. He's a pioneer of genetics. And in his private research, he tied with the Human Genome Project in mapping the human genome, and it's work he's continued to do. He has a new book now, which is called A Life Decoded, My Genome, My Life. Now, you began your genome research at the National Institute of Health, but you left the NIH to form your own company, a nonprofit company. Why did you want to leave the NIH to pursue genome research independently?
Well, I think most scientists have the dream that they would love to have their own research institute. And it was an institute, not a company. And I was given the opportunity to have my own independent research institute that was, in fact, funded by a group of venture capitalists that were hoping the results that my institute produced would flow into a company that they started to find faster cures for diseases. But the primary reason, in fact, I envisioned staying at the NIH for a long time when I was there. The intramural program was probably the best place to do research in the country because we had large budgets. We didn't have to write grants, and we had a lot of independent direction, which is how I was able to make early breakthroughs there. But I was also very limited in terms of trying to expand the research. I got very excited about the notion of sequencing the human genome. And it became very clear that was not going to happen at the NIH, certainly not within the NIH. And so having the opportunity for my own independent research organization, I jumped at that chance.
I'm wondering what your thoughts are now about the role of private companies and pharmaceutical companies in this brand new research. I mean, we're facing the possibility of pharmaceutical companies patenting. I'm not really sure what we're facing, but can private companies patent genes or patent variations on genes? Or Are we risking that things that are an essential part of human nature will be privately owned by pharmaceutical companies?
Well, it's a good and it's an important question, and one that reflects a lot of the bias and misunderstanding that's out there. I mean, yes, human genes can be patented like genes from any species. In fact, life forms can be patented, as ruled several decades ago by the Supreme Court. The number one organization for patenting human genes is actually the U.S. government through the National Institutes of Health. There's very few genes that have made their way directly into therapeutics, but some of those are extremely important. The first and perhaps the most important one for any of your listeners that have insulin-dependent diabetes was the original cloning and then the expression of the human insulin gene and turning it into a pharmaceutical product by Genentech and Eli Lilly. The only way they were able to do that was by having a patent which allowed them not ownership of the insulin gene. They don't own mine. They don't own yours. What they have is a legal right for a limited period of time to commercially produce that human insulin. The treatment for diabetes used to be dependent totally on having pig insulin, which people develop resistance to and antibodies to. And so the human insulin has been a lifesaver for tens of millions of people. So that's one of the fallacies about patents. Patents are not ownership. They're a brief limited right that the government gives in exchange for public disclosure of all the information about the invention so other people can build on it to commercially produce what's in that patent. I think if there were not patents on drugs and medicines, we would not have a pharmaceutical industry. We would not have a biotech industry. The government does not produce drugs. In most cases, it has not discovered anything that would end up as a pharmaceutical. So it's an important part of the exchange we make as a society with the inventors, the companies, the institutions that make these breakthroughs so that, in fact, they will find their way into commercial development. If there's no commercial development, we don't have access to them as patients.
My guest is Craig Venter, a pioneer of human genome research, and his new book is called A Life Decoded, My Genome, My Life. And his company tied with the Human Genome Project in mapping the human genome. He continues to do genomic research. Clearly, you are so excited at the prospect of what we can learn from sequencing the human genome. And you're working now on new forms of bacteria that can contribute to the production of alternate fuels. What are some of your concerns about these new doors that we're opening and how they might be misused?
Well, I'm concerned about two things. I'm certainly concerned about the public understanding of science. And I view it's every scientist's responsibility to speak out about what they're doing to help the broader public understand what is being done and why it's being done. And that doesn't get done frequently enough. We've just finished a study and we'll be releasing it soon in conjunction with MIT. It's been funded by the Sloan Foundation to actually look at these risks and to look at laboratory practices for this new emerging field of synthetic biology, which is has some wonderful potential for making new biofuels, new vaccines, new ways of doing chemical synthesis, maybe eliminating the petrochemical industry in the future. That give us a tremendous hope. But I think there's a large number of technologies that do have that potential for abuse that we need to guard against. On the same hand, let me add that probably the biggest threat facing us are new emerging infections. Your listeners have certainly heard of SARS most recently, but HIV, both which have emerged in recent history. As our population goes from 6 billion to 9 billion people over the next 40 or so years, if that prediction is met, we're definitely going to have new emerging infections. Some have predicted new pandemics from flu, but we definitely have to develop new weapons against new emerging infections that could affect tens to hundreds of millions of people on this planet. And that's something that we're falling way behind as a country. Government funding and pharmaceutical company funding has all drifted away from new vaccines, new antivirals, and new antibiotics.
Do you see your research as being connected to medical research now and trying to alter genes, like to find the gene for breast cancer in the hopes that maybe that gene can be changed?
Well, I think the notion of gene therapy was one of the early naive assumptions out of the genetic code.
Naive
in the sense that, you know, like a broken carburetor, we could just go in and repair it. We have 100 trillion cells in our bodies, and the only way that you can repair genes is to change the genetic code for future generations. With rare exceptions, gene therapy just will not work. But understanding risk genes, and I think we're now up to at least a half a dozen associated with breast cancer, and I'm sure another dozen or two will be found as we examine the genetic code more thoroughly, that these are important information that can really help, in the case of breast cancer, women in a preventative medicine paradigm. It's also an example of how inadequate understanding of genetics has led to probably more aggressive changes than probably were warranted. I think many physicians not understanding what the, quote, breast cancer gene was really telling them were telling women that they had a 90% chance or better of having breast cancer when it's nowhere near that. There are only tiny percentages for the general population, other than the very small number of women that have a very strong family genetic history of breast cancer. So I think we have to understand the entire human genome. We can't just look at one gene. There is no such thing as a breast cancer gene any longer. And as we understand the beauty and complexity of our genetic code, I think it will take us in a positive direction.
You've sequenced your own genome. When do you think the rest of us would be able to get our genomes sequenced? Like, how far down the line do you think that is?
No, it's a great question. And so we just published my genetic code as the first diploid genome that truly represents what an individual human genome looks like, because it has both sets of chromosomes contributed by my parents. The cost of sequencing genomes is changing exponentially, from a multi-billion dollar federal program down to $100 million at Celera to the sequencing company that just claims to have sequenced Jim Watson's genome, and we're waiting for the scientific publication on that, but they claim it cost only a few million dollars. There's new technology coming out of several companies now that we think could lower the cost right now to maybe $300,000. So you can see it's changing very rapidly. So I expect within 2 to 5 years, it will be cost-effective for us to do the 10,000 human genomes to try and understand this next level of interpreting our genetic code. Certainly within a decade, I'm part of the XPRIZE Foundation, where there's now a $10 million prize for the scientist that developed the technology to get us to very rapid, cost-effective sequencing of human genomes so that it will be available to wide aspects of the world's population as we go forward. So there's certainly opportunities with several groups now over the next year or two. I'm hoping it will become a major part of preventative medicine and healthcare for all individuals in this country within a decade.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, I enjoyed your questions and your discussion. So thank you for having me.
J. Craig Venter's new book is called A Life Decoded, My Genome, My Life.